from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. February 1985 is Black History Month. Recognizing this, Soundings now presents the third segment in a series of discussions about Afro-American history and culture. The Soundings panelists are two scholars at the National Humanities Center, Armstead Robinson of the University of Virginia and David Barry Gaspar of Duke University. Their topic in the following discussion is the idea of emancipation and racial freedom in North America and the Caribbean in the 18th and 19th centuries. Where does emancipation find its philosophical origins in the New World? Who are some of the major figures in Afro-American history associated with the development of emancipation in the Americas? Armstead Robinson is at work on a book about emancipation and the American Civil War in the Mississippi Valley. David Barry Gaspar is writing a book about Afro-Caribbean slave revolts in the British Caribbean in the 18th century. Is it fair to say that the struggle to win a full measure of freedom for black people in the Americas, does that continue today, Armstead?
I would say certainly it does. You must remember that the first blacks got to what's now the Americas in the 1520s with the Spanish and what was then Florida and South Carolina. The first slaves got here about 1619, and people have been struggling ever since then to acquire a full measure of freedom. Emancipation didn't do the full job, and one still, I think, is in a position where throughout the New World, both the Caribbean as well as North America, South America, Central America, they're descendants of Africans who still exist in less than ideal conditions.
Barry?
Of course, during the period of slavery, we can in fact talk about blacks who were free, but that raises some very interesting questions about the meaning that we attach to freedom, or in fact, more important, the meaning they attach to freedom. I think the definition of idea of freedom changes over time depending upon what group of blacks you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Let's pause on that. Armstead, are the words emancipation and freedom, are they the same thing historically as you look at what blacks in the Americas have experienced?
I don't think so. I think that if one could retrospectively interview slaves just before, for example, the coming of emancipation in the United States, they would have told you that for them, freedom meant not only the end of slavery, but also access to the full range of equality.
My sense is that a lot of Americans are short-sighted about this, that we connect it with Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. Obviously, it goes back farther than that. Tell me about that.
I think that the idea of emancipation begins with slaves. It begins with the slaves themselves and the way they organize their lives in order to not just survive slavery, but to emerge from it intact to some extent. Later on, what happens is that various groups of liberal-minded non-slave people within societies begin to think that there is something morally correct in espousing the general goal of emancipation. So in a sense, what they're taking the lead from the slaves themselves, because I think what this amounts to in the end, the big question that has to be asked, I mean, when people think about Abraham Lincoln as a great liberator and so forth, I immediately find myself asking, well, what I'd really like to know is how and to what extent did the blacks or slaves themselves contribute to their own emancipation? And that to me is a fascinating question.
Armstead, can you comment on that?
Well, I think it's certainly true that Lincoln's reputation as an emancipator is probably warranted in the sense that he did issue an Emancipation Proclamation. It's also true, however, that scarcely 18 months before he issued the proclamation, he said that he wasn't going to do it. Something happened between his inauguration in March of 1861 and his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862.
And what was that?
Something that happened was a slave freedom struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Black folk heard that Lincoln was going to become president. They'd been convinced by propaganda within the South that Lincoln was an abolitionist. He was not. Nonetheless, they acted as if he was.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of seeking to realize the dream that they had been told, they forced the hand of Northern authorities again and again until finally emancipation did become part of Northern war policy.
Mm-hmm.
To shift geographical focus, in the Caribbean, something pretty similar was taking place in the sense that the abolitionists in Britain were given ammunition which they could use to project their case of emancipation by what the slaves themselves were doing in the Caribbean, for example, in the period after the 1820s, especially the slave revolt in Jamaica in 1831. You see, in other words, the emancipationists in Britain could point to the Caribbean and say, listen, this is what is happening down there, and this is what we're trying to avoid, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm suggesting is that if the slaves themselves had not got directly involved in what they understood to be a struggle for their own future and so on, probably would have had a very different kind of story.
What form did this involvement take? The first word that springs to mind is protest, rebellion. Am I right?
Well, in the United States, the form that's most directly relevant to Lincoln would be the runaway slave problem.
Mm-hmm.
When the war started, Lincoln insisted that his people enforce the Dred Scott decision, which required federal authorities to return runaway slaves. In 1857, the Supreme Court had ruled that in the Dred Scott decision that the federal government did indeed have an obligation to enforce the return of fugitive slaves. When the war starts, Lincoln is trying to save the Union by also keeping slaveholding states, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, in the Union. And so his initial policy was to try to persuade them that slavery was more secure in the Union than outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do that, and since the Northern Army had to cross those states in order to get to the seceding states, what he had to do was to issue policies which told the members of the Union Army that they had to return runaway slaves. That was supposed to discourage them. In fact, they couldn't, because slaves kept running away. As they kept running away, they formed human contact with individual soldiers who said, this is wrong, I won't return them. And so policy from the president was undermined by the creation of an alliance between common soldiers on the front on the one hand and runaway slaves on the other.
Mm-hmm.
It said that you couldn't fight a war against a slaveholding power and return slaves to them. Important thing to remember is that despite all of the laws to the contrary, a significant number of slaves learned to read and write.
Uh-huh.
Many of them worked as domestic servants in their masters' homes. They were the ones who picked up the newspapers, brought them in. They were the ones who picked up the letters. People learned.
And it was against the law to teach black people to read and write until when?
After the Civil War.
Yeah.
It was against the law for a very good reason, that if you owned slaves and you knew that these people were human beings, that if they understood the full compass of what was going on in the world, that they might kill you in your bed, they might poison you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the self-interest would dictate a policy of seeking to deprive these people of access to information. In the case of what Barry's talking about, there's a very famous slave rebellion in the United States, the Denmark Vesey Revolt in South Carolina in 1822, where the goal of the revolt was to get some ships to go to Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
They knew about Toussaint Louverture. They knew about the Haitian slave rebellion when the slaves in Haiti, reacting to the French Revolution, had risen and destroyed their home plantation economy. So no, the slaves in South Carolina knew about it. Indeed, one of the reasons that a number of the southern states had laws which required black seamen to stay on the ships when they were in port was precisely the attempt to try to make sure that these black folk who went all over the Caribbean, all over Europe, could not, just by the mere fact of getting off the ship, walking about the docks and talking to black folk, spread the word.
Mm-hmm. Barry?
Yeah, I wonder about this, and I think this is a very good point. This anxiety on the part of slaveholders in the South to kind of contain black seamen and so on suggests to me that blacks in the South were pretty, in a sense, hungry for information of what was going on outside the confines of their own small world. I mean, that would be my guess, because I don't think that slaveholders would have operated within a sort of vacuum.
I assume that the slaves were very much like any of the rest of us, that when you're confronted with the forbidden fruit, told that you can't know this, that it creates an enormous desire to find out what it is that they won't let you know about.
Mm-hmm. Armstead Robinson, Barry Gaspar, we're talking about black emancipation in the Americas, principally in the 18th and 19th centuries, but we've noted that this is something that continues today. A moment ago, Armstead mentioned a rebellion in South Carolina in 1822. What are some of the other historical events or major people, figures in history that you associate with this whole process of black emancipation? You've talked about Lincoln, for instance. Are there others at that level, or do we need to go a little deeper, secondary historical figures?
Well, I would think that for black Americans, perhaps the most important figure in this process would be Frederick Douglass.
Uh-huh.
Frederick Douglass had been born a slave in Maryland. He was taught a skill. He worked on the docks in Baltimore. Experienced the frustration of being as skilled as a ship caulker as anyone else, but not being able to earn the fruits of his labor.
Mm-hmm. Because he was black.
Because he was black and he was a slave. Mm-hmm. The frustration was more than he could deal with. He finally ran away to the North, and he became the preeminent black intellectual of the 19th century. He became the relentless spokesman for emancipation, for mm-hmm. freedom. And after the war was over, he remained until he died in 1894. Mm-hmm. The major black spokesman arguing for the full realization of his dream of freedom and equality.
Does Douglass have a counterpart in the West Indies, in the Caribbean, Barry?
Okay. What I would say is that the major spokesman for emancipation in the West Indies, I would have to say, would be Toussaint Louverture, not in terms of his speeches and lectures and so forth, but in terms of his involvement in the Haitian Revolution of the 1790s. Because one of the things that becomes quite clear as scholars study revolts and conspiracies in the period after the 1790s is that the image and the meaning of Haiti continues to figure prominently.
Why is this?
In Barbados in 1816. In other words, Haiti, what happened there suggested a model, a positive kind of image that black slave leaders in other parts of the New World who were concerned about liberating themselves by their own efforts were quite willing to follow and quite able to do so. Mm-hmm. And the image of Haiti also has a terribly strong impact in North America as well, in the United States, as I think Amstead mm-hmm. has pointed out in some of his work. This question about the attitudes towards emancipation that would have been harbored by or held by slave leaders and other slaves, I think this has a lot to do with the nature and character of the slave community that we're dealing with. Because if we start, let us say, from the 17th century, I mean, we're dealing with a slave community that would be very different from a 19th century slave community when Afro-Americanization or creolization has taken place. I want to point, for example, to the kind of alternative types of approaches, for example, that slaves in places like Jamaica and Suriname and Saint-Domingue in the Americas had ideas that they had about emancipation. In other words, these guys wanted, during a very early period in territories where you had forests and jungle and so forth and so on, to establish communities which were alternative to mm-hmm. white society as it existed. Genovese calls these restorationist kinds of attempts.
In other words, this is not integration that we're talking about.
No, this is not integration. It's removal.
Yeah.
It's removal and an attempt to reestablish African patterns of existence, African patterns of tradition and so forth and so on. And that kind of alternative way of life, or mm-hmm. that enclave that's established by these Maroons, which we call Maroon societies, sets up some very, very serious problems for the colonial authorities in those times, because it really does suggest to slaves on the plantations that there exists an alternative to the plantation.
Well, how did the plantation owners deal with this? How did they deal with this alternative that you're suggesting that the slaves might have found attractive?
Okay, well, in a lot of cases they tried to mount search and destroy missions, mm-hmm. to go into the forest, to go into the mountains and jungle and so on, and wipe these people out. The other very important case, for example, of the Saramaccas in Suriname, where this was attempted for a very long period of time. But by the middle of the 18th century, it became clearer and clearer to the authorities that we have to adopt some alternative strategy because it's costly to us.
So in other words, guerrilla warfare is certainly nothing new.
No, absolutely not.
That's what was going on. Armstead?
I was going to say that there are in the United States certainly a significantly fewer number, but nonetheless a number of examples, particularly in the southern part of the United States, that is Louisiana, South Carolina, where you got fairly heavy swamps. And I might add in the Great Dismal Swamp in Virginia, that there are evidence of communities of Maroons, mm-hmm. slaves who ran away, mm-hmm. managed to get into an area that was so difficult to reach that they lived there, and who lived there for years and years. History is very often the study of the irony inside of the irony inside of the irony.
Uh-huh.
One of the, for example, more interesting ironies is the fact that in the Caribbean, you began to get in the 1890s the development of a vision that the destinies of all people of African descent were tied together. And there's a Jamaican, Sylvester Williams, mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. becomes the creator of something called Pan-Africanism.
Uh-huh.
The idea that all people of African descent, that their destinies are bound together.
Oh, no, we don't assign that to Marcus Garvey?
Sylvester Williams started it.
Uh-huh.
This is in the 1890s. He uh-huh. held the first Pan-African conference.
Mm-hmm.
Garvey was a disciple of his.
Mm-hmm.
What gets very interesting is that this Pan-African movement has a lot to do with the creation of something called the Harlem Renaissance.
Which comes in the 1920s.
Uh-huh. And that in turn, the Harlem Renaissance has a great deal to do with exciting the interests of people in African intellectuals
uh-huh.
in their own liberation, which has a great deal to do with the African independence movements of the 1940s.
Uh-huh.
And in turn, those African independence movements of the 1940s, which come to fruition in 59, first with the independence of Ghana and Nigeria, play back into the American civil rights movement of the 1960s. So there are connections, linkages, and there, as I said, ironies inside the ironies.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the third segment in a series of discussions apropos of Black History Month, February 1985. The Soundings panelists are two scholars of Afro-American history and culture, David Barry Gaspar of Duke University and Armstead Robinson of the University of Virginia. Both are fellows at the National Humanities Center. Armstead Robinson is at work on a book about emancipation and the American Civil War in the Mississippi Valley. David Barry Gaspar is writing a book about Afro-Caribbean slave revolts in the British Caribbean in the 18th century. Here is David Barry Gaspar.
The Haitian Revolution takes place in the French colony of Saint-Domingue. I mean, Haiti is really the name of the independent republic after Toussaint, in fact, declares it a republic. But the Haitian Revolution grows out of certain kinds of currents of ideology and conflict that are unleashed by the French Revolution. In the Caribbean generally, those kinds of currents come together with currents of protest
uh-huh.
that the slaves had been mounting for a long period of time, even before that. I mean, names come to mind such as the poisoning protests of a guy like Macandal, who had these grandiose poisoning schemes that he would operate in Saint-Domingue or Haiti. But, I mean, the very important thing about Haiti is that it's the first black republic, the first successful black revolt that we can, in fact, point to. And it seems to me that in that sense, and following from what Armstead has said about communication networks and how information spreads,
uh-huh.
that the Haitian Revolution stands as a tremendous beacon. I might say a colossus that bestrides the world of the Americas and points to certain kinds of directions in which slaves who were really serious about seizing freedom would do so. See, the point I want to make here is that for many slave leaders, freedom was something that you took. You didn't have given to you. If people talked about giving you freedom, that was not freedom. In all the philosophical and ideological sense that one can attach to that, freedom had to be
had to be seized.
Yeah, one of the things that happened in Haiti was that the attack on the slave system in Haiti by the black revolutionaries resulted in the destruction of the economy. Now, some people might argue that was a hell of a cost to pay, but that is not really the point that we should be concerned with, because we're talking about the destruction of the symbols of enslavement, the symbols of subjugation by the slaves. On top of that, what they did was to build a very powerful image. The economic system in Haiti pretty much represented what slaveholders and slavery stood for. That had to be destroyed. It was destroyed during the revolution. But on top of that, the slaves were able to build an image of a new world emerging. Now, this world had to be struggled for. It had to be remade, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Were they all black people in this society? Were there no whites? Why was it successful? Give me something concrete.
The demographics are that Haiti was at least 95% black.
Mm-hmm.
There's a relatively small proportion of whites. Obviously, in any situation where you have an oppressed people managing to break through and win freedom, something has to happen. Some slippage has to take place in the pre-existing system's degree of control. In the case of Haiti, what happened was that the French Revolution, which again is sparked by the American Revolution, the French Revolution had led some of the Haitian slaveholders to begin to wonder whether or not they could do what the American Revolution had done, a group of slaveholders gaining freedom. There's a very, very good book that's done in recent years by a man named Edwin Morgan called American Slavery, American Freedom. Mm-hmm. Morgan argues that the concept of freedom that Jefferson developed is impossible, incomprehensible outside of the existence of slavery. That for Americans in the 17th and 18th century, freedom was defined by the absence of slavery. And so that they could define freedom in terms that are indicated with the Declaration of Independence by looking at it as the thing that was separate from and different from slavery. Mm-hmm. So that, no, I think that there's very little question that the ideology of freedom that the Enlightenment put forward, which Jefferson fused in with the American condition, is something that only takes root inside the context of a society in which, on the eve of the Revolution, every single one of the 13 colonies had slavery as a legal institution.
You had to have this tension. You had to have this opposition.
I think that is what creates the ideology of liberation.
How does the idea of liberation, of emancipation, does it live in the 1980s? Where should we look to see it? How would you characterize it in contemporary terms? Armstead?
Seems to me that one looks no further than the recent presidential campaign of Jesse Jackson, for example, to give you some idea that as you listen to Jackson talk about the unfulfilled strivings of generations of black folk who wanted to be free, people who followed Martin Luther King Jr., who voted, who sought to be free, it's very clear that people still have a burning quest to realize the dream that was put forward in the American Revolution, in the French Revolution, in the Haitian Revolution, by slave rebels like Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, by Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass.
Now, we talked earlier about the ironies of history. Is it possible to say that we should be unconscious or unaware of race at all as a political issue in America in the 1980s? In other words, if we have a black candidate, do we consider him a good candidate? Why should we consider him a good candidate?
Well, you've asked several different questions. Let's try what seems to me the most explosive one first. I think that there's an insidious attempt by conservatives to argue that the solution to the race problem is not to pay attention to it. This whole madness where you want to have race blind things as a means of getting around affirmative action. It seems to me that all that does is to freeze the existing inequality in place. It's only when one takes account of past inequalities and seeks in a very constructive way to try to deal with these that you're going to move from what is to what ought to be. Now, as for the question of would you, in an evaluation of a person as a candidate for office, take race into account, I simply say, look, you've got a person standing in front of you. You've got an opportunity to weigh him or her based upon what he or she has to say to you. I'm reminded of something that Frederick Douglass said when he argued that so long as any American was unfree, that the freedom of everyone was in danger. There are many Americans who are still not free. Many of them are black, others are poor. The continuing challenge of emancipation seems to me to American society is to realize the noble dream, not to be satisfied with half measures or three-quarters measures, but to continue to attempt as best one can, not to pretend that the racial problem doesn't exist, but rather to struggle manfully to eliminate the problem.
Barry Gaspar, Armstead Robinson, let's conclude. You are professional historians. Let me put something to you here that you may find, well, an opportunity to be self-serving. Why should people read black history? Why is it important? Why do you find it important? Barry?
I find black history important because, for one thing, black history allows me to study in depth the capacity of human beings to overcome frightful odds, to overcome disadvantages through centuries, and to always have before them some kind of goal that generation after generation they strive for in their lives. And it seems to me that one of the things is to continually give meaning to freedom as the world changes and as we move from generation to generation. Black people should never lose sight of the fact that what they enjoy today is in fact something that has been achieved by generations before them that has been bequeathed to them. And it is something that one has to treasure. But one does not have to think that the end has arrived, mm-hmm. that there is still a long, long road to go. I continually think of the civil rights movement and so forth and so on, that some of the objectives achieved by the civil rights movement are sometimes looked upon by some people as ends in and of themselves. And it seems to me that there's just so much more that has to be done. And in fact, what is very important is that one has to protect or defend what has been achieved, the territory gained. And as a black historian, I mean, you know, all of these things are very important to me. One of the things I'm concerned about, however, in studying the black history of the United States and of the Americas generally, is how does the history of that segment of the population help us to better understand the history of the totality, the history of the people who inhabited the region. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can we, following these people from Africa into the New World, understand something about societies as they begin to take shape, the problems that they have, how they are solved, and how does one then project into the future in terms of preparing for possibilities?
Mm-hmm. Not only an answer, but a challenge there. Armstead?
When you ask why should one continue to study black history, I'm reminded of the enormous increase in interest in all kinds of history that Alex Haley's book Roots produced.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me that my own scholarly career is an example of something where you start out studying intensely about the history and experiences of black folk. You suddenly realize that these things connect up with the history and experiences of other groups of people. My current work is now mostly on poorer whites in the South. What happened with Roots is, I think, what happened to me and what has happened to a lot of people, that once you begin to see that there is no large amorphous American mass, that there are instead lots of people with distinctive histories, cultures, sections of the country, regions of people, that these histories are enormously rich. They deserve to be studied and preserved. And to the extent that one understands the full diversity and richness of American life, to the extent that studying black history helps us appreciate that, and helps whet other people's appetites for understanding more about their own history. It seems to me that black history has enormous amounts of things yet left to offer to American history, and that is the attempt by Americans to recapture their lost sense of themselves, of their past, of their families.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the third and final segment in a series of discussions related to Black History Month, February 1985. The topic was the development of racial emancipation in North America and the Caribbean in the 18th and 19th centuries. The panelists were two scholars who are currently fellows at the National Humanities Center, Armstead Robinson of the University of Virginia and David Barry Gaspar of Duke University. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about a classic of medieval English poetry, the moral allegory entitled The Vision of Piers Plowman. The Soundings panelists will be two of the modern editors of Piers Plowman, George Russell of the University of Melbourne and George Kane of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.